I missed it by a beat, that closing little snare drop. Hey, good morning, everybody. Hello, folks. I see some good mornings in the chat. Lovely to have folks chiming in. Hey, let us know, too, in the chat where you're chiming in from today. It's always fun to find out where folks are in this particular game that we get to play here every 2 weeks on Instructional Designers in Offices Drinking Coffee, which, folks, don't forget, is brought to you by Domino One, the solution that helps organizations create, manage, and deliver impactful and engaging learning at scale. Hey, engagement is what we're chatting about, though, today. And folks, we have the infamous Clark Quinn with us. Clark, I've known you for a long time in the e-learning space. Surprisingly, there may be some folks who have not met you before or encountered you somewhere in our space. So give a sense of where you're coming from to the folks who are joining us here today.
Sure. And a pleasure to be here and welcome everybody. I guess I saw the connection between computers and learning as an undergraduate. It's been my career ever since. Still a bloody long time, I guess. My first job out of college was designing and programming educational computer games. And that focus on making experiences engaging and yet also effective has continued. And I saw a call for cognitive engineering, taking what we know about how we think, work, and learn, how our brains work, and applying that to design solutions. And I went back to get a PhD in that. And that's essentially characterized what I've done ever since. But it turns out even cognitive science talks about engagement. They talk about cognition, affect, and conation. And conation is the element which is essentially your commitment to learning, your willingness to go out and do it. And that's what we're talking about, Lark. So... That's hopefully a good thumbnail.
No, it's fabulous. You bring a depth of knowledge, experience, a whole career. And actually, one of the things I find interesting is that you're one of the few folks I know that actually sort of found this career without coming kind of into it sideways, in a sense, because so many folks in our space start, you're part of the HR and you become a trainer, or you're the subject matter expert in something and you become the trainer because you have that knowledge, etc. And of course, we all grew up going into a classroom where there's somebody standing in the front of the room presenting knowledge, pushing it by osmosis into our brains. And that's the model of learning that we've all understood. So for so many of us in this space that the coming into this and doing this work, we really have to learn how to actually help people actually learn, not just brain dump information or throw facts and information at them. And it remains a topic. We've been doing this for so long here on Idiotic, and it's still a constant topic for us in that front. So let's maybe talk about that third word there, conation. Let's talk about that, because I'm going to bet that a lot of folks here, it's actually maybe a first time hearing that from them.
It's not a well-known term. So cognitive science recognizes it's not all cognitive, and they get into this. So you can read Lisa Feldman Barrett has a book on emotions. But when I say emotion, I'm actually not talking about fundamental emotions like fear, disgust, or so much as sort of three things that I use emotion as a shortcut to. And one is your motivation to learn. And I've since become acquainted with self-determination theory, which is a really nice framework for thinking about motivation. It's been well validated academically. And that talks about your autonomy, your freedom to achieve goals, your competence in achieving them, and your relatedness being with other people who support this. And there's a whole bunch of therefore to each of those specific actions you can take to help make an environment that's conducive to learning. But I also think about anxiety, and Amy Edmondson talks about psychological safety. And I think that's an important element as well. A little bit of anxiety helps, but learning is an anxious activity, really. There's some trepidation about having to learn things many times. It's this U-shaped curve, the Yerkes-Dodson law, which basically says a little bit of stress helps. And after that, your performance decreases. And I think we have enough of that. So we need to keep that anxiety really low. And then the third thing is building your confidence. so that at the end of the learning experience, you're willing to give it a go outside the learning experience in the real world. And to what you were saying, Chris, about school, so often we create learning to give people a bunch of knowledge about the topic and then say, go figure out how to apply it. We don't give them any knowledge about how to, what you should be doing and even practice in doing it before you go out and it matters. Instead, we just test your knowledge. Oh, let's ask them about this and that, and then we're done, right? And that doesn't lead to it. What you learned in school, you probably had to figure out again how to apply it if any of it was relevant to what you're doing. It's got the wrong curriculum and the wrong pedagogy. Other than that, it's fine. Not the two most important things. So there's a lot that goes into that, but your intent to learn, keeping your anxiety low, and building your confidence are the three elements I really think we don't pay enough attention to in design and learning experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so often we're just handed a bunch of information by the team that we're working for on this particular project. And yeah, no recognition, no understanding as part of the process that there are things that we have to bake in and work in. So what would be some strategies then to help folks with those three things?
Well, the first thing I think, even before you give them the objectives of what they're going to be able to do, if you do a good job with objectives, that can solve some of this. But I think you have to help people understand why they should care. We don't do that particularly well. We don't, when first people come in, go, this is what you're going to be able to do at the end of this. And that's what, this is why it's important. So people are going, oh, okay. Yeah. You know, I do need this. You really want that reaction of, I do need this. And I don't know it now, by the way. Still a lot of people think, you know, I do need this, but I know it well enough. And you sometimes have to slap them upside the head and get them to recognize that they don't. And then you need them to say, and I believe this experience will change. So you, and to be fair, a lot of what we've done in corporate learning hasn't been effective, and we've lost that trust. People don't want to come to our courses. They'll get pay their kids to click through stuff rather than actually engage in design it because we haven't made it meaningful. So that's the second part. We have that hook. We say, with him, what's in it for me? I will be able to do this thing that I now get is important, or I knew was important and I knew I needed to address it. And now you're making, giving me the solution. But then we have to deliver on that promise. We just made a promise that we will take you through. And at the end of this, you're going to have that. We need to deliver on it. And that's why instead of giving people a bunch of knowledge and testing their knowledge, we need to be putting people in situations where they're using that knowledge in ways like they're going to need to use it after the learning experience. Technically, they call that retrieval practice, and with desirable difficulty so that it's not just easy, trivial. I mean, how many times have, you know, let me ask this of the audience and I'll ask this of you two as well. How many times have you seen questions where the alternatives to the right answer are so silly or obvious that you could have gotten it right without knowing anything?
Too often.
Absolutely. When I ask that question of audiences, everybody raises their hand. And it's maniacal. What learning outcome comes from that? Nothing. It's too easy. It doesn't challenge you. We have empirical evidence that the right level of challenge actually leads to better learning. But we don't do that often enough. And so if it's too difficult, it's frustrating. If it's too easy, it's boring. And in between is where learning happens. And that aligns with Zixin Mahalia's study of flow and with Vygotsky's own proximal development. And as you get more capable, the amount of challenge you need increases. Do we ever think about that? No. Dan asks, there are other question types? Yes, the knowledge question. Yes.
That's true and false, right? Obvious question.
Right. We can take ordinary multiple choice questions, knowledge questions, rewrite them as mini scenarios where we put people in a situation, ask them to actually, what are you going to do? Are you going to do this, this, or this? That's a far better type of question. I'm running a workshop tomorrow just on how to do that right as a simplest step we can do. And Pooja Agarwal did some research where she showed that you could ask low-level questions, knowledge questions. You could ask high-level questions at applying that knowledge. And you wonder, there's always been this story that, oh, well, you have to make sure they know the knowledge first, and then you can ask them the high-level questions. Well, mostly we don't even ask the high-level questions. But Hirsch showed that in terms of being able to solve high-level questions afterwards, which is what you really have to do when you have to perform, you not only had to ask the high-level questions, you didn't need to ask the low-level questions. The high-level questions actually caused you to have to retrieve the knowledge to solve those problems. And so you streamline learning experience, but you focus on important questions, not knowledge test questions. And it seems to be an entirely unknown result in our industry. Now, I'm not, just because of what you and I have seen in so many courses, if we have any questions at all, we have knowledge test questions and nothing else. And that's not going to lead to any change.
Yeah, I was thinking you were talking about, really the ROI for learners. What are they going to get out of? What are they going to be able to do better? Which hopefully is linked to the ROI overall for everyone in there. But it also made me think about when you're thinking about games. When was the last time someone played a game where pretty much the whole game was explaining mechanics, everything else, how it works, and then you were just asked some questions about it there? I mean, you were thrown into that situation and you had to solve it on your own and figure out what that was, or some trial and error in there. You were applying a lot of things immediately. And of course, those are the ones that people come back to pick the game there. They are an expert in that game in terms of that, or those skills that the game actually perpetuated for them.
Well, that's exactly right. Too often. Now, you have to be careful. There are sort of frame games that you just dump content into and manipulate it. Now, if you absolutely need to know that stuff by rote, that's not a bad way to do it. But I will suggest that 90%+ of what's going to make a difference to organizations is not the ability to recite rote knowledge. It's going to be the ability to make better decisions. And a properly written game where you're going in and having to make decisions that affect the outcome of the game. And if you look at the commercial games we play, largely not necessarily the Twitch games and things, but when you're playing an adventure game or role-playing game or something, and you're going in, your decisions actually affect the outcome. You have tutorials that teach you how to play the game, and then you acquire it, and you learn heaps about all the mechanics that make that world work. And we could be applying that for learning when it matters. The cost games are still more expensive typically to do a deep, meaningful game. You can do branching scenarios as a step up from what I was calling mini scenarios, those better written multiple choice questions. To go the next step to actually have it programmed, people have claimed you can have frames to dump it in, but that depends on the content and the decisions. And I think you have to custom build those. And that is increasingly easy, but it's still a level of difficulty more than, you know, even branching scenarios. Mini scenarios, branching scenarios, and then there's a long way up till you get to games. So my first book was on how do you design games for learning, and I absolutely believe it's viable and important. It's just to justify that cost, it really has to make a difference about whether they can get that stuff right. But games have this amazing thing, you can do probability in them. And so you get more replay. Branching scenarios have limited replay. Games can have great replay. So I think, Paul, that's absolutely, you know, great way to build learning. You just have to justify that the skills that they're acquiring are ones that are worth that cost in terms of the benefit. And maybe we don't do a good enough job of analyzing that, because maybe if we did, we would find a lot more games for learning.
One of my very first, well, let's say the third project maybe that I worked on was for a financial institution. And they have the classic know your client sheet, but credit to them, what they did was they really wanted people to understand that you weren't just going to go start to finish and say, what's the name of your company? How many employees? They were trying to teach them how to ask open-ended questions to reveal more information more broadly, or uncover things that might not even get mentioned, where something more conversational, they could pick up and find more opportunities, et cetera, to provide services. And the first version that we built was very branching and very realistic. There was a client built on an actual existing client profile, and there were real questions. There was the classic good path, there was an immediate dumb path, but there was a middle path that took you down and you got mediocre results. And you got told, though, that you could have done better, go back. And a year and a half later or so, not quite 2 years later, I always describe this as the privilege. We got the privilege of revising it with the client, and they had a whole pile of feedback. And the very first feedback that they gave us was, okay, that branch that took the learner down the mediocre path, we need to close that quickly, because everybody who took that got angry that they were in the simulation long enough to feel that they were doing well, and then to be told partway down that they'd made poorer choices, not bad choices, but they could have done better. And they were angry that they'd spent all this time in this branch. At the same time, I'm thinking, yeah, but that's invaluable learning. You know, those are the consequences of the decisions. And we took it out. It was a much shorter path and flipped you back to the main path very quickly.
I'm with you on that one. It sounds like a really powerful learning experience. I remember we had a overconfident population. This was selling trucks, really fancy ones. And they immediately wanted to drive it and show it to the client. Problem is, there were so many features on this, you only had about 20 minutes to show stuff. You wouldn't focus on the things that mattered to the client. And so we built this branching scenario, and I should say my client built it, and I just answered questions at times about how to get it built properly and tough thing. But their overconfident salespeople would go into that scenario and very quickly drive the truck over to show the client. And at the end, there was a quiz. What should you show this person? And there was a bunch of things. And only a few of them were right. And you wouldn't know if you hadn't gone down and done the deep research. And none of them were doing the deep research. And they were doing badly on the quiz. And this highly competitive audience then was highly motivated to go in and actually pay attention and find out what they were supposed to know and do to do much better. And that goes back to what I was saying about slapping people upside the head about being overconfident that they actually know this, even though they don't. They need it, but they think they know it and they don't. And sometimes, not everybody, there will be people who go, absolutely, oh, I know I don't know this and I know I need it. That's great. But sometimes you'll get, yeah, I need that, but I know it. And you may have to slap them upside the head if the evidence is they don't. And that was what we did. But see, yeah, they were confounding, well, it depended. Did they have evidence that negative emotion turned people off, or did it motivate them to do more? That was an important discrimination. I suspect they weren't looking at that, judging from what you just said.
Yeah, the feedback we received was that they received a lot of feedback themselves, of frustration. And the framing that they gave us was, these are folks who are trying to do this in between actual sales, the real work, et cetera, and then felt that that was a frustrating use of their time that was not a positive contribution, I guess, or whatever. So,
well, if you could achieve that same outcome of them recognizing they need to know more with a shorter path, okay. But otherwise, yeah, it sounds like a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I was thinking about your, obviously, the sales opportunity, like, and some of the emotions there of an engagement of, they came in, they want to sell more, and especially there's big payoffs probably in selling those big fancy trucks there. So they were able probably to see that linkage right away. And that's a bit more obvious scenario. I was thinking back to, it's amazing over the years when you think about the content that you worked on or you experienced that really had the impact. And thinking back to one where we, again, early and around the same time you built that course, I remember that one too, Chris. This one was about insurance fraud, and these were state auditors. Apparently, maybe that doesn't seem as exciting there, but they put that into the role of a detective, if you will. And they went out and experienced all these different things and had to make decisions, and there was branching. I think one of the things I liked about that design is that you could go off course, but you could get back on course by making corrective decisions. There'd be multiple scenarios, if you will. So you could do mediocre in one, good in another. And therefore, overall, like in real life, there were good results. But I'm saying a lot of us, when we are working on different content pieces, let's face it, some of it's compliance. What are some of the simple things that we could think about doing instead of the standard way of doing it to start to look at tweaks that aren't necessarily a big, hey, we don't have time, we don't have the budget, you know, to go ahead and think about that gaming scenario that people could start to apply to create that engagement and help the learners link it back to, hey, this is important to be able to get the coffee break sooner because I could do my job more efficiently.
Yeah. So there's a couple things that come out of what you're saying. And I like to make a point about compliance. There's a reason they put that stuff in place. And too often, I don't see compliance courses making that visceral, that you should really go, whether it's sexual harassment or money laundering, whatever the compliance course is, there's a reason they put that in place that's really important. They wouldn't have bothered of going through the policies and stuff if this didn't matter to people's lives. I remember my better half saying, oh, I just had to go watch a sexual harassment video. I mean, she's not going to, she's more likely to be the victim than the perpetrator or the observer, but nonetheless, she had to do it. And yet we should really make that compliance competency based so that you would say, can you do it or not? And you can test out by demonstrating that you did recall it from the year before, instead of having to just go through and spend an hour on it every bloody year. That's what's going to kill people's motivation. And it doesn't necessarily increase their abilities. Now, I realize companies don't care about compliance because it's just CYA, cover your assets, right? You're not trying to actually change behaviors. And yet we could and we should, really. We really want people to not just take the class and then go back to do the same old bad stuff. We'd like them to fix it. And if we were focusing on competencies and skills instead, that would be another issue. I'm going to make a small segue here because you triggered a thought about games. One of the things people want to do are points and leaderboards. And for highly competitive audiences, that can make sense. I remember reading a case study about a company where they were doing this with their sales staff, and that made sense. But somebody made the claim, and I think it may be apt, that for other folks that aren't very competitive, the 10% that do well on those leaderboards are motivated, but it's dismotivating for the folks who aren't that top 10%. And I really worry that that's just they think they're addressing engagement and they're actually countering it. And when you do what you're talking about, Paul, and what you were talking about, Chris, when you make these meaningful scenarios where you really get to practice the skills and develop your ability, and particularly if it's not just you go through once you get a grade, but you can go through it until you do well, suddenly you're giving people the chance to do the things they recognize are really important. And that's part of delivering on that promise, is have them doing the things that matter and then give them the minimal information it takes to succeed. Don't give them everything, all the nice to know, whatever. I like Kathy Moore's map it here, where she said, you know, there's the task and here's the minimal information you need to succeed at the task. And cognitively, we know mental models are increasingly, we're recognizing there has been research on mental models for decades, but we're now finding that our brains build mental models continually, this predictive coding model of cognition that says we're building models. And if you give people good models up front and basis to make predictions about, if I do X, this will happen. If I do Y, that'll happen. This is better than that, I'm going to do X. If you give people those mental models, that's a really useful bit of minimal information that allow them to make these decisions better. And we also know that if we don't give people models and they acquire a bad model, when it's proven wrong, they don't say, oh, please, sir, may I have another model. They patch it and they patch it. And this isn't good from the purposes point of view of developing a useful understanding and ability to transfer to all appropriate situations. So, which brings up one other issue, which is context. And we don't pay enough attention to context. And yet, if I give you a bunch of negotiation about dealing with a vendor, you're not necessarily going to be able to transfer those skills to dealing with a customer. The space you transfer over is highly likely to be the space you train over. And so if you don't give people vastly disparate context, they're not going to be able to apply the skills in other situations that are relevant. You may have to give them some negative examples at the edges if they'll over transfer. But otherwise, it really matters the choices of the settings you give them in these experiences. We have sort of an intuitive sense, but it's much better to be rigorous about it to ensure the likelihood of transfer to all appropriate situations and no inappropriate ones, which really should be what we care about. Retention over time till it's needed, transfer to all appropriate situations. Those should be our goals for learning. And those are the formal goals from cognitive learning science, basically.
Yeah, it made me think of a couple of things right there. One is that confidence factor. And I know plenty of people who are not as competitive, and it actually reduces their confidence by seeing leaderboards. And that made me kind of think about when you're talking about the context and how often we see training, even compliance training, like I was thinking about safety. And there's some very, we work with some great vendors, DSS and UL, who have some fantastic safety training because they actually put you into that situation, you know, hey, this is could be death, you know, for me or hurt somebody there, and really show that situation. But context is can be a subtle changes, and you may be having training for a big audience, but their context, like you said, one group works with a vendor, one with a customer, and you as an author developing that content, well, most of the principles are identical. So you're like, hey, let's just make it generic-ish, you know, and you can do that. But I'm thinking having that content change slightly for each of the different audiences, so it's more context specific, which there's ways you can do that still efficiently, single source design and whatnot. But how big a difference that can make, because we think, hey, it's learning how to go ahead and communicate. That's the same or whatever.
Well, I think that's right. And that's, I've argued a long time that we should not be hardwire our courses together. And so if, to your situation of, you know, we need one for the customer negotiators and one for the vendor negotiators, we'd create two hardwired courses instead of having little content objects that then can be pulled up and said, oh, this person's in customer negotiations. Let's pull up the customer practice for them, customer X and customer Y and customer Z for them. Whereas this other person who's getting the vendor, they're going to do vendor A and vendor B and vendor C. And we could be pulling those up by rule instead of having to hardwire it. How we start getting adaptivity is, oh, you failed at this level of vendor negotiation or this particular facet. You're not doing well. Let's give you a little more practice. And we have some more practices available specifically with that feature. Or we give you a bit more of the content on that, another example, and a little bit more practice, we can start writing rules like this and start creating experiences that are personalized and adaptive. But we need to make sure that we're designing things in ways that support that. And it's not just we need content about this, but we really need to design those specific different things based on their role in learning. And when we do that, we have the opportunity to really create experiences that matter.
Mm-hmm. One, I was saying a little bit about Chris's scenario and the complaint about, hey, I spent all this time going through it. It made me think back to my younger days of reading many choose your own adventures. And I enjoyed the fact that I could, you know, maybe I didn't die right away or whatever in that particular, but I didn't like that when I could just flip back to that. I'm wondering how much of, again, back to confidence of, hey, your feedback, you know, on this, you don't like the feedback, you want to try again or go ahead and step back. Can't do that in real world, but again, this isn't real world. It's the practice situation.
Well, that's it. Can you go back to any particular decision and see a different path? And that's partly, you know, what is your navigation support to make sure you can get through and find those specific things? And also, but yeah, we absolutely want to try different decisions and see the outcomes, the consequences. That's how we learn how the world works. And making that those decisions accessible, if the experience is short enough, you might just restart and go through and try different things. If it's longer, though, yeah, you probably should be able to navigate in and just go, okay, this is where I went wrong. Let me start from here, make a different choice and see where I go. Mm-hmm. And so you're beginning to track, you know, cross a couple things there. And unfortunately, our world is not all nicely carved up. Everything's connected. When you tug on any part of it, you find it's connected to the rest of the world. We're crossing some interface and navigation issues with some learning issues there, which is why we say develop a prototype and test it rather than if you build it, it's good.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just those abilities for a learner to make those choices, to return back to something easily, et cetera. I mean, that's all about the self-determination aspect of what you were mentioning earlier, supporting them in that inquisitive nature, supporting that versus pushing them down, I don't know, at the end of the sausage tube or something.
Well, yeah, the more people can take control of their learning experience. And way back when we developed an online course and we had the ability to jump around, but we also had follow the bouncing ball. So for confident self-learners, they could take control of their experience. For self-learners who didn't have that self-learning confidence, they could just do the prescribed experience. This was before we had a lot of adaptivity. It matters. And yes, self-determination theory would suggest, to the extent that we can, we do give people control as much as they want. We do have evidence that you shouldn't just give total freedom. People aren't necessarily good self-learners. And so putting constraints around that so they don't stumble off and determine something that's not accurate isn't a good approach. So we don't want pure constructivism, pure exploratory environments. But I mean, way back in 1985, Wallace Feyerabend was talking about guided discovery. And really, that's what it is. And if you look at, there's folks who say, oh, you have to have direct instruction. Look, we get empirical results. And that constructivism, that pure exploration doesn't work. But that's not what constructivism really should be. And when you look at their direct instruction, they need to explore in this carefully designed little experiment. Yes, exactly. They're exploring in a structured environment so that their explorations will yield what they need to. They will unpack the relationships they need to understand. And so there's really not the two contending viewpoints. There really is a convergent view that's appropriate for both.
Mm-hmm. We would be remiss if we didn't mention that you have spent a career chronicling so much of this in a variety of resources that folks can obtain, your website, your blogs, et cetera, but also a whole bunch of bound versions of this thinking, et cetera. And we were talking before the session here, your most recent book, Make It Meaningful. And you were mentioning that it includes a lot of processes and resources, a lot of what you're talking about here. Anything in that from the perspective of sort of practical things that people could look to that book for?
Absolutely. It's broken up first into two parts. And the first one is that hook we were talking about. So when I mentioned, I do need this and I don't know it now, and getting people to know that viscerally, that this is important to them before you tell them what the experience is going to be and what's going to happen and what their outcomes are going to be. So that's the hook part of it. And then I talk about landing using a fishing metaphor, and I'm not a fisher person, so I probably bung it up. But the point is you have to land them. You have that promise and then you need to deliver on it. And there's lots of elements about how a little bit of exaggeration and a few other tricks we can use to take it from boring to engaging while still being effective educationally. And then I also talk about a process. It was designed as a complement to my learning science book. ATD came to me and said, would you edit the learning science book? And I said, I don't want to herd cat. So they went away, but they came back and said, would you just write your own little brief learning science book? And I did. And I realized, yes, that's the learning science, but you really need the engagement story. And so my view is that those two books together, these two together, tell the LXD story, learning experience design, as I think it ought to be delivered. So we are making sure we get the learning science right. We're melding the engagement in, and the process part of that Make It Meaningful book rehashes some of that learning science, but talks about a process to put them together in an effective way. Because long ago, in the early days of education computer games, they would try and put game designers and instructional designers in a room together and think that what came out would be great. And if they didn't really understand how they worked together, you ended up with chocolate-covered broccoli. Not a great idea, really. They were putting bells and whistles on top of boring learning. But if you understand those principles and do it together, you can systematically, reliably, I have this claim that learning can and should be hard fun. not just trivial fun, but not misery either, hard fun. And you've seen this when you play computer games, that people will spend hours figuring out all these relationships. We can do that for learning too, if we're willing to spend the time and understand the principles. And that's what I'm trying to tease out and build a process that allows us to do that. What do we need to know up front when we do our analysis? How do we have a process that makes sure it creates creative experiences, but also effectively builds in the decisions we need them to be able to make, and so on? And that's what I think is really important for our field, to go beyond a bunch of knowledge dump and test. And so that's why I created that second book. At one point, I'd wanted to write an entire LXD book, and I started writing it and realized it was going to be monumental. So I was able to break it up into two separate ones that I think accomplished that and met the requirements of the publisher.
I once picked up a book. I ordered it online, and I believe the actual title is Rapid Instructional Design. And the book was this thing. And I thought, I get that the title's about the end goal, but there's a lot going on there. So, you know, bite-sized chunks, I guess. Chocolate-covered broccoli reminds me so much of the phrase that Cammy Bean came up with, the clicky-clicky bling-bling, doing things that look good or suggest something about engagement. Oh, let's drag and drop to categorize these things and don't move us more to actually changing behavior or giving people models, et cetera. Too much of what we do in that design type of approach is a trivializing of wrapping up boring learning in shiny things, but it's still not effective.
Well, yeah, click to see more. Isn't that engaging? It's a way to just dump more content on you. I love Cammy's phrase. I think it's a great categorization of too much of what we see being happening. And still, I mean, she coined that phrase over a decade ago, and it's still happening. It's still a tragedy. And I think something when you said very early on about you move laterally, you were an HR or you were a subject matter expert and you get pulled into training. She called it in her book, The Accidental Instructional Designer. And that's, I think, probably one of the banes of our industry, is that you don't necessarily have to have the grounding in the learning science and the engagement. And you're given an authoring tool and told it will make it all easy. And to the point you also made, everybody's been to school, seen this ability to recite facts and pass tests on facts. Therefore, what I create with the authoring tool will do that as well. And it's just not what leads to learning. It leads to ability to pass tests, but that's largely what's going to make a difference in our organizations.
Yeah.
Have you seen any fads or things that have come up of like, hey, this will solve your engagement problem that you'd like to take the opportunity to squash for our audience? That because a lot of this sounds very concrete. Some of it, I'd say, hasn't changed in 15, 20 years. Maybe we have better ways or ways to accomplish it, but.
Yeah, there are so many. My book before the learning science book was on myths in our industry, and that includes learning styles. We still see that continue to manifest. Generations as a nice shortcut. Our brains do want to, it's appealing to think that we can break people up by how they learn or break people up by their generation. It just turns out to be invalid when you look at the science. There are better ways to do this instead of learning styles designed for the learning outcome you want instead of generations. Look at people's experience. Don't try and categorize them by when they were born. Categorize them by what they've known, what they've done, and where they've come from. Generations, I was suggesting to my colleague that he probably has a lot more in common with somebody younger than him but grew up in his area than a Somalian farmer that's his same age. That's not the age. Time he was born isn't the determining factor in what he's been able to do. So it's, but you're setting me up for a rant, Paul. Right now, I'm a wee bit concerned about people using tools to generate content faster. Content, as we've been saying repeatedly throughout this discussion, isn't what's going to make a difference. Deep practice is what's going to create abilities to do. And so just using tools that make it easy to produce content, whether authoring tools or generative or anything else, isn't going to solve our problems. And the expectations I suggest will be that, oh, well, with the tool, you can generate content faster. So rather than give you more time to do it better, we're going to expect more content faster. You're just going to work just as hard, but you'll produce a lot more for this of the same garbage. I have suggested, and so you've opened the door for me to suggest here, getting the basics right, understanding what actually leads to learning and building that in before you throw technology at it is going to make a much bigger difference to your impact and your bottom line than just throwing the technology on bad practices to begin with. Technology accelerated bad, yeah, it's still like, bad.
Make no doubt about it. That's a hard step. And it seems like we had 15 years ago or whatever it was that, I can turn my PowerPoint into training. Well, you've skipped that step, the rapid there. And as somebody else I saw quoted, like, yeah, some of the AI use, the quote there is it helps me to race faster to the bottom.
That I fear is true, Paul. And so I like Michael Allen's SAM, Successive Approximation Model, or Megan Torrance's LLAMA, a lot like agile methodology, something, because they focus on getting, and David Merrill too, with his now Pebble in a Pond. And I mean, these are big names of people who have had big influence on what we're doing. And they all are saying, get the final practice prototyped first. In other words, what people are doing is more important than the content. Kathy Moore with her Mapit as well. It's all focused on first figure out what you need people to do and then get them to succeed and iterate, test it, and tune it. We have great principles from cognitive science and learning science. And by the way, neuroscience. When we take we have those good principles, they'll give us some great first guidelines, but then we have to test and tune because people aren't like concrete. We're not as predictable, and there's so many little nuances. And this is arguably the most complex thing in the known universe, the human brain. Thinking you can reliably affect it with simple approaches doesn't make sense. Get some good basics. Prototype a first one, test it and tune it, figure out what's different here, and then you can generate the entire rest of the course in a sensible approach grounded in science and your audience, as opposed to science that's irrelevant for what your current situation is. Mm-hmm. I see Ed's asking, why are so many not approaching L&D like this? I think there's a lot of reasons. Everybody's been to school, so they think they know what learning's like. The industry is aligned on delivering what people think they want, not what they really need. So people are creating authoring tools that are aligned towards taking PowerPoints and PDFs and throwing them on the screen and adding a quiz. There's lots of reasons why, but I think as increasingly we research translators like Will Tallheimer, Julie Dirksen, Matt Richter, Connie Malama, Jane Bozarth, hopefully myself, are saying, when we look at what we know, we need to make this shift. And we can make this shift. We're going to have to do a little stealth, just rewrite our multiple choice questions as mini scenarios and not knowledge tests to start. But when we start having impact, we leverage that and we start shifting our role in organizations to something that's actually a contribution instead of a cost center.
Mm-hmm. Clark, there's a lot of folks who you've just dropped an awful lot of names, and all of those folks have been folks that I've admired, I've learned from, and really value in our industry. And just a gentle nudge to the folks listening, hey, go back and rewind and write those down if you haven't encountered some of those names in that last burst. Clark, our conversation here today has been, to bring it all full circle, very meaningful for me. We really enjoy every conversation that we have with you. You bring so much depth and knowledge in our space to these important things that we all need to be thinking about better. Folks, before we dance on out of here, just a gentle reminder that Domino One, Paul and I both work for Domino, so Domino sponsors this session just as we do every 2 weeks when we bring folks here together. And Domino One is, in our phrasing, a great solution for helping teams create, manage, deliver, and I'm going to say prototype, test, run over and over again, and do the right things in to create impactful and engaging learning that will make an actual difference in your organization here. Check us out, domino.com. we should be shouldn't be hard to find, even though it's a weird spelling of domino. It's not the one you're going to expect if it's the first time you're encountering us here. If they've only been hearing it out loud and they don't see the sign behind me.
We like pizza. We're not pizza.
Exactly. Clark, thanks so much for joining us here today. Time for us to dance on out of here. And we sure appreciate your early morning rise on the West Coast since we are East Coast oriented time zone.
Well, thanks for the opportunity and really enjoyable. Thanks.
Awesome. Give us one more flash of the book. Is it at ATD Press?
This is LDA Press. This is ATD Press.
Perfect.
Folks needing to look for those things. I did the straight D. Yeah, you love them. Much longer story about publishers.
Fabulous. All right, gang. Let's dance on out. Hope the rest of Wednesday is great for you. And we'll see you everybody again in a couple of weeks.